My name's Ken Dull, and the topic is winter survival, or how to cope with cabin fever without endangering the tips of your fingers. The last name is Dull, D-U-L-L. Same as trite, boring, happy. All those Ruth's last name, she kept her maiden name, you can probably see why. It's K-I-T-T-L-E-S-O-N, Kittleson. So Justin's name is K-I-T-U-L-S-O-N, Kittleson. Anyway, that's who we are. It's very confusing. And if you have any questions or answers or wisecracks as we go, please throw them in. Let's keep this awake. If we can, it's going to be a long stretch. By virtue of the fact that you all have been living in essentially in a winter environment, even though winter's a good ways away still, you have already some experience at this. And I'm sure you have some concerns or some things that you recognize as dangerous. And I want to make sure I address all those. So before I start, why don't we make a list of some of the things that you've thought about or are concerned about. And I'll somehow weave them into the things that I'm covering if I haven't already planned to do so. So let's start off at that point. What are some specifics to do with the winter environment, snow, winter conditions here at Holden Village in the mountains that folks have either observed or are concerned about? Let's put them on the board here. Anybody?
Nobody's concerned?
Pardon?
Proper clothing.
Proper clothing, okay. Anything else?
Safe skier.
Okay.
Avalanche.
Hypothermia, big word. Everybody familiar with the word? Because we're going to spend a lot of time with that one. That's really the most important one. Anybody else?
Some kind of survival if you get stuck out there. What do you do?
Shiver. Sorry about that. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Survival.
Last time it happened to me, my ski was broken.
Broken equipment, which is really related to this, too, survival. Let's see, the U goes in there somewhere, doesn't it? Anything else? Frostbite. We'll talk about frostbite. Anything else?
Emergency rescue.
Why don't we go over here? We tried to get in twice there.
I was going to say, mind you related. Any tips for preventing frozen fingers and toes?
Yeah. That's prevention of this. Same time, correct. And somebody said something about rescue over here.
Pardon me. What did you just say?
You started to say something?
Emergency rescue for accidents.
We won't touch that one today. We got it. But let's mention that rescue.
Is that going to first aid?
Yeah, but first aid could be something a little bit different, may not be as involved as involving a rescue. So let's put first aid up here. What's going to happen, we are in the process of asking Diane Allen, naturalist up in Stehekin, to come down sometime in the next few weeks, and she's going to be working with this one. And then in February, Diane and I are going to be here. We'll try to set up the schedule where we both be here and deal in depth with avalanches. I'm going to touch it lightly near the end with some basics, and they'll be tied together with this. Actually, you pretty much wrote my outline for me, so I don't have to rewrite it. So we can just start in, and we're going to start with hypothermia. I would say, and the reason why we're going to start with this, is that's probably the most important one. because that affects everybody, whether you be skier or just working around the village, waiting for the boat or the bus, helping the bus dig out from an avalanche. Anytime you're outside, if the heat goes out in the building, it affects everybody, regardless of your interest in skiing or not. Everybody here should be aware of hypothermia. So we're going to dive into that one first, and that one the most. And we'll take whatever time we have to do on that one. The rest we will handle. We'll compromise to handle that one properly. Let's see, let's leave that there for a while. What hypothermia is a lowering of the core body temperature. The core. You hear of a temperature 98.6. We'll use that temperature, but actually that is the temperature, you know, you take on your tongue or an armpit or something. That is an external temperature. That is not the core temperature. The core temperature is the temperature that's maintained at the area of the heart, the lungs, the vital organs of the body. So it's your inner abdominal area. So, just for the sake of discussion though, and because a lot of information we have are related to the surface temperatures, we'll use 98.6. That's not exactly right, but for the sake of discussion. At this temperature, we're smiling. Okay. But even though we're at that temperature, we're always emitting heat. Good old calories, and some of us would like to admit others more of those than others, but that's not necessarily good. This is just normal. This happens in the summertime, this happens year-round, but we're always putting off this heat. And if for some reason we get behind on putting out heat, if we don't have enough in our bodies, this temperature, we will continue to put out heat. We'll always continue to put out heat. This temperature can start to drop. If it does drop, we're in trouble. And how much? It doesn't have to drop terribly far before we're in very deep trouble. The thing that can affect this, you know, there's different things that can affect how fast we lose heat and how fast we can maintain this heat. What do you think some of those are?
If you're dry or wet.
If you're dry or wet, very good. What, you know, that has to do with
evaporation,
moving the heat away from the body. Very good. That's probably what number one. What's another thing that can affect?
Insulation,
clothing. That could help. Pardon?
Wind.
Wind will come along, and as it moves, it will carry these calories away. There's a surface layer of heat that it will remove faster than normal, so the heat is disappearing faster and faster if there's a wind, especially if you're cold and wet. Is what I was after. Is it especially wet? Wind and wet. And we can defeat that with insulation. That's how it all ties together. There's another very important aspect about this.
Whether you're moving or not?
Yeah. Food. How does food relate to all this temperature stuff?
Makes calories.
Right. That's how we maintain this. You know, how can we maintain this if we're always giving up heat? It's the food balance. So you always have to realize you were talking about an equilibrium. And food is as important as keeping insulated from the elements, is to keep this thing going. Another thing that's equally important as food is water. A lot of people miss that one. Because that affects the body's balance to use the food. In other words, how to metabolize it and make the whole body mechanism to heat yourself work. So one of the big things that's related to hypothermia is dehydration, which is a very big problem in the winter. We got lots of water, you're skiing on water, and not a drop to drink. So some elements there. That's what hypothermia is. It's just simply the lowering of this core temperature. Okay, let's talk about clothing was mentioned first as a way to protect ourselves, and then food. Let's just take it in that order. What are some thoughts on clothing? Anybody want to start out? We've mentioned insulation from wind, and we've mentioned we don't want to be wet. So what are some ideas about what's good clothing to wear?
Layers,
lots of layers.
Don't you lose 80% of your heat through your head?
If the rest of your body's uncovered. You have to be careful with these assumptions. Okay, if this person is losing heat, we should, you know, this is dropping. 97, it's like this. Okay. Okay, clothing. We've had something mentioned for the head, which is very important. Hat.
Wool clothing.
Why wool?
Because it sheds water and keeps your, even if it's wet, it still keeps you warm.
Right. Does anybody know why it keeps you warm when it stays wet?
Fibers don't collapse.
Right. Insulation. And it's the same in insulation. The problem with down, even though it's a better insulator, you could stay toasty warm. If it gets wet, it turns into a thin mat. The wool, even though it's wet, because of the way the fiber is, you have a fiber and it's really furry and everything. The water just stays on the outside. And it does not affect the thickness of the fiber. And this thing has air spaces in it. And so the loft is maintained.
Is there a difference between wool and cotton if you're dry?
Not if you're dry. Cotton is okay, but here's a fallacy in it. The only thing cotton is really good for when it's wet, or, you know, looking at the whole spectrum of possibilities, wet and dry, really the only thing that cotton's good for is to cut the wind. The only thing wool won't do is cut the wind. It's good for everything else. And I found this out one day. I was crossing a glacier. This was in the summertime, but up there it was mixed conditions. You know, we started across the glacier, it was sunny, and it was hot and sweaty, and we were going across with a cotton shirt on. And a storm starts to move in, so you just throw a wool sweater over it. And it gets a little more miserable and more miserable. The cotton shirt's wet and sweaty, and the wool shirt's over it. It finally hit me. I took the same two articles of clothing, bared my skin for a few minutes, reversed them. The same two articles were about three times as warm. There was a slight breeze, the cotton cut the wind, the wool provides the insulation, and keeps you warm even though you may be wet and sweaty. So the real kicker is, cotton's good for something, but not next to your skin. And where we run into that the most is socks. People like a cotton sock next to their skin. But that's a real good way to guarantee cold toes, even for discomfort, not necessarily for that.
What if you just can't stand the wool next to your
skin? Don't go outside.
If you decide to go outside, well, this is cotton. And this is the way I normally go. You know, I'm throwing these things out. You go knowing that. And going prepared to deal with it. Either you go short distances and you work up a sweat and come home. Or you go prepared that if you start getting cold because of the cotton next to your skin, that you're going to take it off and put wool next to your skin. To stay, you know, if you're going on a longer trip.
Mm-hmm. Probably does a similar thing to wool though.
Right.
It doesn't sweat.
You have some new synthetics out now that will do the same thing. Dacron vests, if you're looking for bulk layers instead of down, are good also. Wool is not the only thing to do, but that's a good place to start. Wool can be, wool doesn't bother me. People have accused me of being a sheep, but. So, if you are affected by it, there's other good things out. I don't know how they stack up cost-wise, do you know? As far as if you're buying them? Wool is not cheap either. Although you can a lot of times find things in Salvation Army or something, if you're not stuck in home. You might find some wool things around. But any other ideas on clothing? The polypropylene is a very good one that's up and coming. I like the turtlenecks, the cotton turtlenecks, because I have a long turkey neck and it keeps my long neck warm. So, you know, whatever. There's other ways to do that, though, too, once it gets real cold.
I think that when mittens instead of gloves.
Yes. Very much so. Also, wind shells on your mittens are good.
Fur coats, is this Gore-Tex any good?
Okay, well, it is. Let's get into that. We're not talking about more of a wind shell, an outside layer, is what the Gore-Tex parka is. To break the wind instead of, say, maybe a cotton shirt. Parka is actually better. You got hoods and things on that. And Gore-Tex is fine, but sometimes it doesn't work. And when it first came out, if you didn't keep it absolutely clean, it wouldn't breathe. In other words, essentially it would just be a waterproof layer. Now, that gets into the subject of waterproof versus a breathable parka. Does anybody have any thoughts on why a waterproof item might not be so good?
Well, there's a lot of moisture.
Right. You get just as wet inside if you're skiing.
Yeah.
while you're moving, you generate a lot of heat. So, if you're going to have something that's windy out, it's going to break, you want to break the wind while you're skiing, maybe a cotton shirt's fine. It'll break the wind if it's not too wet. You know, it gets clammy around your skin if it's a little wet. But a windproof, a breathable parka, Gore-Tex parka, as long as it's breathing, I get a little worried that it might lose its breathing properties after a while.
Because that happens.
When I first experienced Gore-Tex, there's two types, or there may be more than that by now, haven't kept up with it. When the first type came out, if it got dirty at all, like if you had it out one time and really got into a sweat, the salt and the sweat would plug the pores. So it had to be washed. So you have to wash it every time. They've come out with another Gore-Tex with the claim that it beats that, and I haven't heard any reactions from people who've used it yet. I just haven't heard this.
I read an article last week that they're on their fourth.
Oh, on their fourth, okay. High tech. So, those are the kinds of things that if somebody has something like that and has used it, ask them. But Gore-Tex is pretty good. I would not recommend not buying it, but I'd ask some questions at that price, especially.
Yeah.
Right. Personally, my parka is not waterproof. It's a wind shell. And I picked up that habit from the Rocky Mountains from whence I came, which is extremely windy. And even though I came to the wet climate here, I first used some waterproof stuff because of all the wetness, but I've gone back to the breathable part. Okay? Let's see. Clothing. Dress in layers so that you can adjust your body temperature as you're going, so you're never working up a total sweat. Like I said before, if you're out just for a run, get in shape like a ski race and just, you know, like a jog, you're going to run out there and run back. Nothing wrong with working up the sweat. That's the whole reason for doing it. But if you're going for a longer ski tour, you don't want to get drenched from the inside either. So layers so that you can adjust your body temperature to your physical level. And like I said, in cross-country skiing, you generate a lot of heat. And so you could be very cold weather skiing, or maybe right down to your cotton shirt or whatever, and as soon as you stop, burr. And if something happens to the blazer coming home, then you can really get cold if it gets dark or if you get caught in a storm or something. So you want to be taking some kind of day pack. Again, keep everything in perspective. This doesn't apply if you're just going out to the junction or even further and it's packed and you're just out for a little spin. We're talking about more of an extended tour. Everything's relative. You know, sometimes people accuse me of never giving a straight answer, but it all depends. There's conditions for everything. Okay. Gloves, hat, mittens, good point. Another trick in skiing, especially in cross-country skiing, about keeping your fingers warm. Maybe you've all heard, maybe you haven't. The proper way to put your ski pole on is to come through the strap from the bottom and rest your hand down on it. So the strap is here and your hip is gripping this way. Many times you find people, and you may see guests too, and this is where you can help them out a lot on cold weather, who don't know that and don't know the reason, or if they know that, think it's a lot of bother and they don't understand the reason behind it, and they'll put their hands straight through the strap and grip the pole. The reason for it is when you're cross-country skiing, if you have your pole strap on right, is you don't have to death grip that pole. All you have to do is have a loose grip on it, and it'll keep your fingers much warmer. So, does somebody, did we grab a ski pole somewhere?
No.
It's easier to show you than explain it, so we'll do that. That's just, well, that comes important. I say it's just a matter of way of keeping your fingers warm, but that could also prevent frostbite when it comes down to it. It's not just to make something new for a beginner to remember. There's a reason for it. Oh, my goodness. You can grab my pole. You come up from the bottom and you come down like this. Most of the time you'll see somebody who doesn't know, just come through here. The only way they can hang onto the pole is if they have a grip. By coming through here, when you're in stride, you literally, sometimes are just like this. In fact, sometimes you can let go of the pole. If you're in a full stride, it'll come right back into your hand. So you see, you're just gripping it very lightly like this way. And if you drop it or you know, it's just there, whereas this way to use the pole, it comes back here, and light grip, you don't have a pole anymore. So it loosens your grip on the pole is what it does. It keeps your fingers warm. Neat little tricks. Food. Any guesses on, or any thoughts on food? Granola bars, dried fruits. Why? High calorie, quick calories. Balance carbohydrates. Balance of calories. Sugars, your basic simple carbohydrates, are good to get energy into your system, but you want to keep the system balanced. You want to watch out for your sugars, blood sugars running out. So it's good to have more complex carbohydrates, like the grains in granola or nuts in gourd. So it's good to have a mix. Fruit has simple sugars, fructose and a few of the others. And so they're good for that. But you want to also have some of the more complex things in to provide an even energy supply. If you're going to be out for a while, something with fats in it's nice for lunch. So that, again, the calories are kind of like a tiny timed capsule, right? Timed energy being released. More heat always coming in. And water, lots of water. You can't count on getting water out there. Sometimes you can find a stream. Making water is extremely slow. Eating snow is not good. The heat that it takes your body to melt the snow and bring it to a temperature, you know, you're pulling, what you're doing is you're taking cold water and dumping it into the core. And the heat you're using to bring that up to temperature is more than you're gaining by drinking it. So, you know, we all do it. You know, just for fun every now and again. But for trying to go for a major water supply, you're going to come out on the deficit side if you're eating snow constantly.
You eat snow like you make a fire.
It takes a lot of time and energy to do that, though. Oh, that's very slow. So carrying water with you is usually the best way to go, unless you know where the streams are and you know how to access that water. Approaching a stream or any body of water in the winter is very dangerous. You've got to be extremely careful with that one. There's a trick there, too. It's hard to describe. Too bad we don't have you all out the ski tour. Oh, this isn't.
But wouldn't carrying water get almost as cold as snow when you're
wandering outside? It's chilly, but then you don't have to melt it either.
No, but I just
meant
like it goes into your body.
Yeah, it gets cold, right.
And also in this snow, there's very little water content to add up. You have to
inject
a lot
of them. Right, right. Some people carry thermoses, you know, small thermos, and carry hot. Best is about hot broth, something that's got salts in it, replaces your salts you sweat. Some people on a long tour, and I'll suggest, carry a stove so they can heat something up. Heat water that they have. Of course, then if they get in a pinch, they can make water too from snow. Even though that's a lengthy process, it's better than nothing. If you come to a, this isn't my pole, this is something else. It's the same thing. If you come to a stream, a quick trick is to take your ski pole. I would take it off your wrist. Take the basket and put it into the snow bank where you can get a big mound of snow on it. The problem with the stream in a lake is you just have a very hard time getting very close to the water safely. This is a way to beat that. So you put the basket in a bunch of snow and get a mound of snow right here. Then you take the pole and you stick it in the water and soak it until it's saturated. And you pull it out and then you'll surprise yourself. You know, you'll probably think, oh, this is going to take a lot of sucking. You'll probably drown yourself in the first shot. You get that much water. But again, the neat thing about that, and it's very cold, because you're sucking it through the snow. But the thing is, it keeps you away from the edge of the stream and the pond. Because if you fall in something, stream, and your way out, you are in trouble. Okay? If you're on a longer trip, one clue is to watch your urine. If you're running bright yellow for a long time, you're starting to get dehydrated, you're starting to push things to the edge. It's very hard in the winter on overnight trips to keep up with water. It's probably the most important thing, yet difficult thing to do. Yeah?
Can you become dehydrated without feeling thirsty?
Yes.
So you couldn't necessarily tell?
Not necessarily. In the summer, for example, it's commonly said, and it applies to the winter too, is we hike along and backpack. We never drink enough water. You should be drinking water all the time. We tend to just push on for a long time and don't stop enough. The best way to keep up with this energy thing is to be eating lots of small snacks and taking water constantly, not going for the big, you know, lunch break at the end, at the halfway point of your trip or something. But the simple thing is, if you're cold, do something, you know, maybe move to warm up. If you're hungry, stop and eat. Don't worry about a schedule. Eat, drink constantly. That's the best thing you can do, is pay attention to what your body's telling you, because it's no joke.
Again?
Yeah.
Is it true that once you're thirsty, you're already behind the game as far as drinking water?
Yeah. And as far as the water consumption goes, this is not limited to winter. In fact, it's probably more important in the summer, because if you're high loss to sweat, is people maybe have heard the bit about taking a lot of water in, so they drink a lot of water, but what they've missed is the salts. If you aren't taking some sort of body salts, for example, like a Gatorade, or somehow replenishing the body salts you sweat out, drinking a lot of water doesn't do you a whole lot of good. Because for the body to utilize the water, it has to be at a certain osmotic pressure. It has to do with salt content for all the things to flow through cells and everything. You're dealing with concentrations. So you have to have, the body can't utilize water unless it's at that right level of salts. So if you don't have the salts, it's a weak link.
What are the good ways to get the salts?
The best and easiest way are the Gatorades, the electrolytes, or just, you know, if you're going out for, well, it depends. If you're going out just for a quick spin, it's nothing to worry about. Just try to pick it up in your diet. If you're going out overnight, you might take some salt with you. It's not just table salt that's the problem. There are other salts in it, and it's tough to replace.
And what are these things you said? Gatorade.
Gatorade's a brand name of a drink that has potassium and sodium and some of the other body salts in it.
It's made in England. Yeah.
There are other brand names. I used to know them. There's Glutenate or
EKG.
ERG. Yeah, ERG. And there's some real funny names. They're good to have in the winter. They're good to have. It's one of the best ways to fight heat exhaustion, because heat exhaustion is an upset of the salt and water balance. And if you ever had heat exhaustion, one of the quickest ways to come out of it is with an electrolyte. So, okay, even if we've done all this, sometimes we get in a situation where we're getting behind on this balance. And the body has some natural mechanisms to protect itself. Protect this core. And that's the vital area. The body knows it. It's all built in. And what it will do, anybody going to take a guess? It or no? What will the body do if it starts getting, if your heat balance is starting to get out of kilter?
It will start heat.
How does it do that?
The mammalian response, or not that extreme.
It'll constrict the
muscles. You want like that on me? Pardon?
The blood vessels in your skin, otter.
Right. Exactly what you said, but the mechanism is what he said, and you went over my head. What was this mammalian
response? The mammalian response is what the seals, like when they dive, they lose, it would be the same thing. They only get blood pumping to the
right.
To the brain, that's like four times a minute.
Right. So, your fingers get cold and numb? Put on an extra sweater, or if you don't have a hat on, put on a hat. It doesn't make any sense, does it? But try it. Make sure your body temperature, your core temperature is protected if your fingers are getting cold. That's the first defense, is to bring that back, shut down the blood. Now think about this, because we're going to come back to this later on in detail. It's so the blood doesn't come out here in these little extremities that have a pretty bad surface, you know, volume to surface ratio. That's a good way for it, as the blood circles through for you. The blood to get cooled off, and when it comes back into your body, it's cold. So it shuts the blood down out there, and it pools the blood in the core to protect the core. So essentially, what's another you know, you get a numbing, or, you know, your fingers get cold, then they get numb. What's another body mechanism that works for you to try to keep you warm?
Shivering.
Shivering. You burn off more calories, though, that way. So if you're running a deficit, that's kind of a last dive that your body's trying, because it's going to burn more calories and further the deficit, really.
How does that keep you warm?
What it does, the shivering is a, it's kind of like an isometric. It gets the muscles moving, is what it is. So, you know, you'd mentioned keep moving to keep warm. That's what shivering is. But you'll burn more calories that way. My, one time my sister and her family were trying to save money, be environmentally minded, and keep the temperature in their house really cool, cold. And she was losing weight. She was going to doctors, and nobody could tell her why she was losing weight. She was getting worried. She's thin like I am. She can't really afford to lose a lot of weight. And then we moved from that conversation. One time we were talking, and she was telling me about how they were keeping the house cold. And she said, sometimes I just stay home and shiver. I said, what? I said, that's why you're losing weight. And they went home and turned the temperature up, and she gained weight. So, The point of the matter is.
You started a movement for losing weight.
Let's do it.
Well, okay, let me kind of compromise that position. Shivering is the last dive. It is a desperate move on the part of your body, because if you don't do something fast to keep the heat and energy coming in, you're going to lose. Because shivering takes more calories than any of the Jane Fonda exercises or skiing. I don't want to undo Jane Fonda, but she does. Her method is safer, let's put it that way. You go out there and shiver, you're going to cause other problems. Okay? So those are the body defenses. If you get to that point, you'll see in a minute. We'll go through some signs and symptoms. Okay, any questions or wisecracks that we haven't hit so far that we need to cover?
More susceptible
to
hypothermia and
just
like
generally
then
you're
not
susceptible
to.
What people? No. Because it depends upon how well they're dressed.
Yeah, but I mean, all things being.
All things considered? No, not really. Because, well, the extra insulation helps people. You know, say the bigger people. To have a. Well, I'll back up a little bit. There is one advantage. The extra insulation plus just a bigger volume to surface ratio. Are you familiar with the concept? The more surface area you've got, like in your fingers, compared to the volume, the colder you get. Okay. I have a pretty poor ratio there. Somebody else would have a better ratio. That would keep them warmer. But once the temperatures, you know, once you start talking about energy, you know, converting energy, you know, and you start to say if you're getting a hypothermic situation, The rate at which you're losing heat out of the core is faster than the body can convert fat. Hypothermia acts much faster than the ability to convert fat. So extra fat, once you get hypothermia, will not help you. And it takes a lot of energy to convert fat, too.
Good.
Let's just take off. Thank you very much.
I don't need to do this.
Oh, don't go that way. This is going to be so dramatic and so nice. Oh, one thing on clothing, you mentioned layers and stuff. You'll always see skiers wearing these funny things. This is to keep the area around, you know, between the boot and the pants from getting snow. Keep your socks and feet dry. Gaiters. They don't have to be up to your thighs. They can be short ones if your pants are longer. If you wear funny little short knickers, you need the longer ones. The plug for knickers, though, is that you can regulate body temperatures. If it gets hot, you can vent. So that's why people wear knickers. But, you know, they're not just one of the people. Thank you. Okay.
Now, what would be appropriate for a short thing? What would be more appropriate for a longer?
Okay. I'm dying of heat right now. I've got three layers on. And if you're going for a short spin, just wear what's comfortable skiing, because you can get back. What you're counting on is not stopping. So whatever is a good temperature to ski at, and people who race and do track skiing do a lot of that, that's fine. But if we're gonna go for a short tour, I would take at least, you know, a light shirt that you'd be comfortable skiing in, a vest or a light sweater, and some kind of windbreak parka. And then a light pack, you know, if you don't need them, you can stuff the sweater in the parka in. A lot of times what you may end up doing is wearing a light shirt in the parka just to cut the wind, and you won't put the heavier sweater on. That's a really common combination that I use to keep cool while I'm skiing, but to cut the wind, cut the weather. Does that answer your question? Okay, the further you go, the more layers you're going to need. It's kind of proportional. Any other questions? Wisecracks? Okay. Again, these are dealing with surface temperatures, but just to give you an indication, these are your symptoms in the progression of how it goes. Intense shivering, just what we're talking about. This is the first sign of trouble. Fatigue, slowing of pace, poor coordination. Well, that doesn't work with me, I'm just normally there. So. As you go on down, here we're talking about losing a couple of degrees. Here we're talking about losing a few more degrees. Thick speech, sluggish thinking, a feeling of deep cold and numbness. Moving right on down, you can read as well as I can. A few more degrees. This is one of the key ones right here, and you shouldn't be trapped by this. Shivering decreases. If all of a sudden, and you're not really feeling warmer, and this shivering, you know, decreases or stops, you might say, aha, I'm warming up. Are you really? Think about it. Because if you're not really warming up and the shivering stops, no, it means you're still, in fact, you're getting in worse shape. Amnesia, hallucinations, stiff muscles, disorientation, just the kind of thing you were talking about. The disorientation because, like she said, the blood is an extremity, the brain's an extremity, although well, when you get down here, you'll see why. It's not exactly it's pretty vital. As you move on down, now we're getting extremely, this is all pretty serious. As you get down into here, now this is dangerous, extremely dangerous. Irrational drowsiness. If you've got drowsiness on your hand, you've got one heck of a situation. This person wants to go to sleep. Blue skin, stupor, pulse and respiration slow, dilated pupils. I mean, now you have some real diagnostic characteristics. By the time you get here, you have to do something fast. And we're talking minutes. Well, maybe not minutes, maybe half an hour, 20 minutes, something like that. In that point. Loss of contact with the environment. And down here, the consciousness. And down here, the mechanism below. You know, as you get below 80 degrees, you're really in trouble. This is where your comment was really valid. The first thing that shuts down at these temperatures, because blood's shutting off to the brain, is the brain control for respiration and cardiac control. And if that center shuts down, then you have cardiac fibrillation, and you get into edema, which is fluids in the lungs and hemorrhaging in the lungs, and then you have death. And you see, we're talking, and the shocking thing about hypothermia is look at this temperature, 78.8. Where all this starts happening. That's not very cold, really. People have died of hypothermia in 55 degree weather. You know, this is not something that's just limited to the sub-zero weathers we're having. This is something that we have a lot here in the Northwest because of our wet conditions. Any questions or additions to that?
You're talking about being out alone. I mean, if you are with someone else, I mean, body contact, like, you know, your hands or feet, you can get them in somebody's armpit or on their belly.
Right, we'll get to treatment here in a second. I'm just describing symptoms right now.
But if you're by yourself, at what point do you arrive at where you cannot think clearly, where you can even take any action?
There's a sluggish thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Even a pirate, you gotta be on your toes to catch it even here, yeah. Because you just think, well, I'm cold, I keep plotting. People have had the equipment on their back to correct the situation, and they've plotted on and died. Because they don't know what's happening to them. And the thing is, this is really subtle. You know, it sounds so easy here where it's warm. One thing I'd recommend, if you really want a good visualization of this thing, is a film called By Nature's Rules. It's put out by Mountaineers, I believe. And it's excellent. It actually goes through an example, and it's kind of funny when you watch the film. Oh, let's get off this ridge! You know, these kind of things. It gives you a real good, it really shows you what it's like. And the reason I say that is I've experienced it. Went back when I was first learning about these things. I saw that film on a Wednesday. I had my first case of hypothermia to take care of on Saturday. And I don't know, to this day, I have no idea. I'd never even heard of hypothermia before that. I have no idea if I would have done the right things. That film may have saved that guy's life because he was here. So that film, and I've seen it several times since then, the Forest Service has rented it from someplace, so it's a good film, I still think it's a good film. So that might be a good one to handle because it visualizes it for you, and it actually puts it in context. Where we're talking about it here, it's hard to put it all together and actually get the feel for what it's like as it happens. Okay, let's talk about treatment. What would you do? Oh, question.
Yeah, I was just going to comment that I think it's important to think about what you think is a short spin, and I don't really need that much to take a month. Because, for example, I know a group of us went out last weekend, we went out to Hart Lake, and none of us, for us, that was not that big of a deal.
Like, right.
We had one amongst us, we had one water bottle and no food, and, you know, we had this roll of layers on the trail. So, but after we got back, Cindy and I were talking, and we were saying, that was really stupid. Because, you know, it was only an afternoon's trip,
right.
You know, but it was dumb to not have extra stuff. So we were thinking of it as just a short out, but it,
right. Exactly. What is considered a short spin is relative to ability levels. And I would say that as far as we're concerned here, and given our situation, a short spin stops at the beaver ponds, even for the better people. The reason I say that is that the grade up to Hart Lake is an avalanche trap. It's also exposed to high winds. You come out of the shelter of the valley. That's the point. It's just as far as something that to put a handle on here at the village, I would say the beaver ponds is where a short spin stops for anybody. Now, the beaver ponds may be a long jaunt for some people. I'm not saying that that's the only definition. And I think your conclusions are very right. But personally, I consider Hart Lake a short spin.
And along those lines, this is a problem to you, but maybe to the village, that if people are going to do stuff like that, we have to be able to have access to maybe an old gun or something like that. Maybe it would be good to sell them in the store so that, because you don't sell
for them. For any speed trip like that, you can get food presentation.
Really? Even if it's just like an afternoon, you're not taking a lunch from them?
You can get snacks or things like that.
Oh.
You can always get, I have never seen Holden Creek. You know, that's the creek you cross on your way to the beaver ponds. I've never seen that to a point where you couldn't get water out of it. But there's some years that happens too. And that's where I usually use that trick of the ski pole, by the way. It's a good place to stock up on water. But I'd still carry water. I'd always carry water, even if it's quote short spin. Anything past the trail junction, I'd recommend water. And a lot of people who've never done much skiing, a trip to the trail junction, they should take water. It's all relative to ability levels and what you're accustomed to. If you can move efficiently on skis, actually, if you'll exert less energy maybe going past the trail junction than somebody who's new will exert going to the fall pond. It's just a matter of efficiency.
The thing I think of too is if you should fall or if you should hurt an ankle or something, you have to lay there in the snow until somebody gets to you. You better have a pull on or have something available underneath you or whatever.
Let's, before we dive into that, let's answer that comment.
There's no danger of contamination in the water in this drink.
Hold
it.
GRDF. Well, I can't absolutely say that, but I drink the water without doing anything about it, especially in the winter. There, if you want to be a little on the safer side, go to the uphill side of the trail, because that trail does get horseshoes in the summer. The thing to watch out for, more importantly than, say, Holden Creek, would be the beaver ponds. Don't go near it. That is one of the, beavers are the worst carrier of Giardia there is. So downstream of the beaver ponds, I'd be very careful. The beauty of Holden Creek is it flows in where you cross it before it joins, before the two streams join the beaver ponds. So I'd watch out for Railroad Creek. But I think Holden Creek, in the winter, it's okay. I would be a little more leery of it in the summer when you have horse traffic. Of course, you don't know what's up above. Well, we know what's above. It's Holden Lake. If you've got any, you know, hikers that aren't too considerate, you could run into troubles there, too.
How about a dead animal in the stream upstream?
Yeah, that would could pose problems. But in the winter, they'll be frozen. Well, did you hear about the Russians that found a mammoth? All frozen and intact, and had, you know, once they thawed it out, it was going to rot, so they had mammoth burgers. That's true. Another one is, oh, no, let's not get into that. Well, I can't avoid it now. When some people are doing some stuff on the ice cap in the North Pole, you have these glaciers that are on top of the water, and underneath this, right underneath the ice on the water is a super cool zone, meaning it's below 32 degrees. It will stay that way as long as there's no vibration. You know, it's static. You can get super cool water, it doesn't move. So a little fish comes swimming along and doesn't know this. It swims into that layer, ching, instant freeze. And it floats, of course, ice is lighter than water. It floats to the bottom of the ice cap. Well, the ice is all is dynamic, and it moves through, you know, over hundreds of millions and thousands of years, I don't know, through this thick ice cap. And then they get out in the middle of the ice cap, they see these fish flopping around. And they pick them up and they go cook them. And they're hundreds and hundreds of years old.
They're alive.
Well, I don't know if they're alive. I was flopping around. That was kind of hard. That's a good story. Point is, they're fresh enough to eat and be safe to eat. Okay. Anyway, that's diverging a little bit here. Okay, we better treat this hypothermia before we die of it. We've gotten down here. What would people suggest for treatment on this one?
Which stage are we talking about for this at all?
Pick one. If you got one you think you have an answer for, pick one and tell us about it.
If you can get hot liquids at all, you get some hot liquids into the body.
Right.
I mean, if you've got a skull model, that would be one thing to start doing if you have a number of people.
Very good. Probably one of the best things to do. Although, this is one of your books in the library, Freedom of the Hills. They've got a short section on hypothermia. I don't think it's all that great. I've seen much better publications. 436 is this table. Got more information. This is where these temperatures came from. And it talks about symptoms observable in others. If you're out and you see it in others, the things you can see in yourself. That question came up earlier. That's all broken down here for you. I kind of took key things out of all of these and summarized them here. But if you want to further it, it's in this book. It's brand new. What was I getting to there? Oh, they say do not give hot liquids. They don't back it up, though. And to me, giving hot liquids or warm liquids is the first thing to do, because it takes the warmth to the core. I don't know. They don't explain why. There's some questions about that there. And this is a current edition. This is the one that just came out last year or so. Anything else? So hot liquids is a possibility. Okay, think about this diagram here.
Cover up.
Cover up. Exactly. If you're wet,
If you've got a wet layer near the skin, get rid of it. Get a dry layer. If it's windy, get out of the wind or put a layer on the cut the wind. Essentially what we're talking about is the first thing is to improve your condition. In other words, try to cut down your heat loss. And now we're talking about a matter of minutes.
Is it not good then to rub your hands and stamp your feet because that will draw heat away from the center of the body? Is that bad?
No.
It's okay to do that.
What you're doing is you're kind of imitating what the body's going to do later. You're doing isometrics, and if you don't do it now, shivering will do it later. It's the same thing. So that's trying to get warm, but the thing you have to do is correct the situation. Shivering doesn't correct. If you're losing enough heat to get cold like that, what you need to do is get dry clothing on, get sheltered from the wind, whether that be by putting a parka on or putting up a tent or, you know, rigging up some kind of shelter. You have to correct the situation first. Because even though you warm up like this, if you continue to stand around, you're going to get cold again. You know, if you warm up like this and get going, that's fine. Eat something. Get the heat going. But you've got to do something to correct the way that the heat balance is sliding. If you don't do that, just standing around and stomping your feet won't do much more. Did that answer your question?
You mentioned the fallacy of drinking anything with alcohol.
Okay, good point. Did everybody hear that? He said something. What about alcohol? What do people think? You know, the nice warm feeling you get after a drink. Wouldn't it be good to take a bottle of booze around, like the barrel of the St. Bernard wears around under his throat? What about it?
It's a depressant, so it can dilate.
You're right.
So you lose more damage.
Exactly.
It dilates extremities with blood going too long.
No, he's right. Why would dilating the blood vessels be a problem?
You get on the skin, the blood will be back out in your extremities.
Right, you're fighting the body's natural mechanisms. It's cutting off blood to protect the core. You're taking the heat from the core and putting it out in the skin. That's why it feels warm. It's bringing blood back out to the surface. Forget the alcohol. Really, in fact, one of the high categories of people who are threatened by hypothermia. Everybody's threatened by hypothermia, but the high risk area is alcoholics. Another strike against alcoholism. Okay, treatment. Anything else? Any other shots?
You can reassure a person who's in that state. Try and book his states up.
Yeah, tell them what's happening.
Yeah.
Also, in that point, is don't let them go to sleep. Okay, let me organize it for you a little bit here. We're getting most of it, but it's kind of scattered. So let's go to treatment. Okay, we've already talked about the first one. You've got to stop further heat loss. In other words, change of clothes or more clothes or put more heat in. You've got to improve the situation where they're losing heat. And you've got to do that first. In other words, if you're out skiing along in a blizzard and somebody's, you know, showing signs like this, you can't just feed them food. When they start sliding, and I'm not sure where on the scale, if it's up here or down in here somewhere, once they start sliding, their body is incapable of recovering on its own. It needs an outside heat source. So the first step is to prevent any further heat loss, but you immediately, that's only the first step, that will not stop the whole process. You immediately have to turn around and do something. Get them in somewhere, like I said, feed them food so they can generate more heat, or the hot liquids is the fastest one. You know, if you're carrying a stove, you can heat up something and pour down their throat. In the meantime, you have to keep them sheltered from the weather. You've got to keep them awake if that's a problem. You might tell them what's happening, too.
This is a victim often part of a little difficult to handle, not realizing what's happening. They're saying, no, we're getting off there. And you've got to deal with that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but if you can come up and scare them with high terms like hypothermia, blah, 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 maybe you can intimidate them. No. But if you know what you're talking about, is what I'm getting at, and you can spot off what's going on, I think you can break through that. Or, you know, they're irrational, so maybe being rational doesn't work. But it's a problem you're going to have to deal with. If you can't get food into them, you're going to start talking about body heat. And if they're unconscious, of course you can't. If they're semi-conscious, you better watch out for trying to put liquids into them. But if you're on a day trip, you're not going to have a sleeping bag along and stick them in. And of course, the classic example is to strip them down, strip yourself down, climb into a tent and sleeping bag with them, the body heat, and then warm them up. Who's going to have all that equipment on a day trip? So that's of limited value in a lot of our cases, but be aware that's the thing to use on a longer trip, is to get into a sleeping bag with them, skin-to-skin contact, and warm them up that way. The other problem with that, especially when somebody's right here, and that's, of course, when you start to think about using this thing, if they're way on the edge here, if they're right on the edge, the problem with skin contact is that if you warm them up on the outside first, what you're opening up first are the blood vessels at the surface. And they're cold at the surface. And what that's going to do is the blood circulates, it's going to pick up that cold layer out there, and there's going to be an initial slight loss in body temperature. The core is going to lose initially before it starts to warm up. And if you're right on the edge, you know, could that be enough to push them over? An academic question. If you're out stuck in the woods and you don't have heated oxygen to give them to them, that's the only thing you've got to do. You know, you're going to do it. And that is the treatment. If somebody, for example, were found unconscious close to the village, don't mess with this climbing into the sleeping bag with them. I don't know if you've got heated oxygen, do you?
Oxygen. How do you heat oxygen?
I know how they heat it. It's just so that it's warm, so that when you put an oxygen mask on an unconscious person, you're putting heat into the core.
I don't know.
One way of doing it, we have the oxygen equipment, is we can just run the oxygen tube through a bucket of hot water,
okay,
or something that way. We can heat the oxygen now.
And it'd be something to look into here, because this is a technique, if somebody, you know, drops right close to the village, that's how you're going to have, that would be the best way to handle it, is to bring them in and give them heated oxygen. And that's how they do it at most emergency rooms. That's the most severe case. Okay. I think we've covered that. Any more? Is there a need for clarification on that, on the treatment?
The other thing I've heard with, again, when they're getting to the lower layers, is to take a blanket or a space blanket, and he said, instead of put it on like a diaper, where one corner comes up this way, one here, one on the inside of the body, and leave the legs and arms out. So as,
cool,
as you said, keep, just let the other part go.
Okay.
You don't send the whole body.
Well, I'd ask some questions about that. I was wondering what they're thinking. I would see that as a technique to prevent further heat loss. I don't see how that's adding heat. You know, what you're doing is wrapping the body and saying maybe the heat, internal heat, will build up enough.
Yeah.
And see, once you get down here, you've lost that capability. There's not enough heat there.
Yeah, I assume there was something else with it, like the heated oxygen or...
Yeah, that's something I don't know about, and I would have some questions about, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
What if I'm just at heart lake and I need to add some water and I'm there on a day trip and I don't have a stove or a soup to make a tent, how can I add heat?
Food. You know, but if he's unconscious, you know, those are kind of things you have to think about if you're going to Heart Lake. And we'll talk about that in a minute, what we should be carrying on longer trips like that. So if you're going on a longer trip, those are the kind of questions you need to ask yourself. Am I really prepared to handle something like that?